Follow a Liberal podcast. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the October 14th episode of the Delaware Liberal podcast. In this show, Delaware Dem and Cassandra score an interview with Lieutenant Governor candidate Matt Den. This is part one of the interview. Part two will be published in a few days. Matt brought his son with him to the interview, so you'll hear a good deal of baby talk and incoherent exclamations. But that isn't a Republican in the background, it's Matt's son.
Okay, and it's Cassandra and Jason Melrath here for Delaware Liberal, and we're here with Lieutenant Gubernatorial candidate Matt Den and his son, so if you hear any noises, don't worry about that.
It might just be me, you never know.
Thank you for coming and meeting with us today.
Sure.
Yeah, we do appreciate that a lot.
Absolutely.
My pleasure.
Good.
I guess the first question I wanted to ask about was your own blog. You've been keeping your own blog for a while now, and your blog is a lot of fun. What got you to start that blog, and how come you don't have you don't allow comments?
I started the blog because the people that we pay lots of money to tell us how to run campaigns told me that it would be a good way to communicate directly with people and to try to bring people back to the website because if you don't have new and interesting content on your website, then people tend to look at it once and then go away, and you want people to keep coming back. So they encouraged me to write something myself and not have it be filtered or edited. And I think, you know, on certain days they regret having given me that advice. But on the whole, I think it's served its purpose in that, you know, we as best we can track it, we do have a pretty good return visits to the blog on a regular basis, and the readership keeps going up at a pretty steady pace. I don't know why we don't allow comments. I could guess what their reasoning was, the guys who run the website, which is that it can become sort of you know, an avocation for people on the other side to, you know, put things on your website that you might not want to be there. But I'm not sure. I don't actually. I'm allowed to write the blog, and I don't really have the technical expertise or know-how to really adjust any part of the rest of it.
Well, the biggest reason to ask about the comments, our founder has routinely lamented the fact that your blog doesn't allow comments.
Jason. Is he referred to as the founder now?
The founder.
I like that. He's assumed Jeffersonian proportions.
Exactly.
Almost like a prophet status.
And I think it's mainly about a way to interact with, you know, the very interesting comment and, you know, a lot of the wit that you have in your own blog. And I think that people would like to just interact with that more. But I understand about, you know, basically keeping it on a focus and not getting...
Well, I'll ask them about trying to put comment. I guess we could try to put them on for a couple days, and if it just turns out to be "you stink" 20 times, then we can always turn it back off again. But if it, you know, if it turns out to be what you're describing, maybe it'd be a good idea to keep it that way. So I'll ask him if we can turn the comments on.
Okay.
Great.
All right. Do you read any of the national blogs that like the Daily Post or any?
I do. I read Talking Points Memo. I read. Does Politico.com count as a blog? I don't know.
Sort of. It's more news now than, yeah.
Yeah. I read House Files, which I guess is across... Nice. I don't know if he counts as being a progressive or what he is.
Right.
He's sort of off in his own corner of things. What else do I read? I read some non-political blogs. I'm a sports fan, so I read some blogs that, you know, involve...
I've been reading a lot of Phillies blogs.
Like. Phillies and that kind of thing. And I actually read some blogs on the other side of the political spectrum, too.
Okay.
I try to make sure that I know what the other guys are talking about. And every once in a while, you know, they have something that's smart to say. So I try to keep an eye on both sides.
Okay, good, good.
Well, right. Going to the campaign, we got some good news for your campaign yesterday. HYY came out with a poll showing you leading 53% to 38%. I just want to ask, how do you think the campaign is going so far?
Very well.
Very well.
We were obviously pleased to see that poll. We have some internal polling numbers that show me a little more ahead than that, but in the same ballpark. So, and that's where we That's where we had hoped to be right around now, is somewhere in the high teens. We're running about 2 points behind Barack Obama,
right.
Which is nothing to sneeze at.
Right.
and substantially behind Jack, but Jack is obviously run a tremendous, very high visibility campaign.
Right.
So I think that, you know, being that far ahead 3 weeks out is both the good news.
Yes, please.
It's both the good news and the bad news, in the sense that, you know, the playbook for you know, the side that's losing by 15 points is
to go negative.
Weeks to go. Yeah, is almost inevitably to go
right.
negative. We're expecting to see, you know, within the next 4 or 5 days, some pretty high intensity negative paid advertising. I can't tell you what it's going to be,
right,
but
I can
pretty much predict the general tenor of it, and that's, you know, that's unfortunate. But you know, you don't get into this stuff if you're not prepared for it.
Thick skin,
right?
Yeah.
If you are successful in this election, what do you view your role as Lieutenant Governor to hopefully Governor Markell would be?
I have a set of priorities, you know, which revolve around, you know, issues affecting kids and to some extent the state's economy. And I've been trying to convince people that there's actually a lot of overlap between the two, that, mm-hmm. that, you know, how our public schools go is largely going to determine how our state's economy goes. So, you know, my intention, I think if you're going to be successful as a lieutenant governor, then you have to carve out some sort of role for yourself. You're
right.
not the governor. You're not dealing with, you know, 20 different issues that affect the state every day. You need to set some priorities and try to take some ownership of them, and then work with your governor, with whom hopefully you have a good working relationship, mm-hmm. and try to move those issues ahead. And you know, fortunately, Jack and I have known each other for a long, 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 long time. And if you have a governor and lieutenant governor working together, then the lieutenant governor's involved in the meetings where the budget's getting put together, which is where a lot of the, you know, critical decisions about state priorities take place, is what, you know, how the governor sends down his proposed budget to the legislature, mm-hmm. Helping the governor set legislative priorities, which again, you know, the legislature obviously, you know, has its own mind, but, you know, what the governor sets out as his legislative agenda for the year in large part determines, you know, what the legislature will be dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And then just the day-to-day issues that come through the governor's office. You can, you know, if you're there and you're a partner who's listened to and respected, you can have a tremendous amount of influence. I mean, outside of that, there's also a lot of opportunity to move a public agenda ahead out in the community,
mm-hmm.
And it's something that I've tried to take advantage of as insurance commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just having a position opens a lot of doors for you, and you get to go in and talk to civic associations and Rotary clubs,
right.
and you name it, and you're able to try to build public support for things
right.
that you care about. And some of the bills that we got passed the General Assembly over the last 3 or 4 years passed only because over a period of years I was out beating the drum in the community for them.
Right.
And being lieutenant governor opens doors, you know, tenfold compared to being insurance commissioner, and
right.
it really gives you the chance to go out and try to move an agenda ahead. And we're going to have to do that, because some of the things that need to get done with public schools and some of the other issues that Jack and I are talking about are not going to be easy, and there's
right.
going to be an awful lot of you know, consensus building, and,
mm-hmm.
and it's almost going to be a second campaign probably. I mean, you
mm-hmm.
have to go out and convince people that there are some tough decisions that have
right.
to get made, and you know, why they need to help, you know, call their legislators and help us move the ball ahead.
Right.
So
I'm
hoping to be able to do a lot of that as well. And I guess the last thing is, you get outside of legislative priorities and government, you also have the ability to go out and, again, because you can get to people, try to build things outside of government. And Tom Carper did a lot of work recruiting mentors for, he was governor, not lieutenant governor, but recruiting
right.
mentors for the public schools. And he spent a lot of time over 8 years targeting individual businesses and trying to partner them up with local schools and
mm-hmm.
getting them to get their employees to go serve as mentors to kids there. And it was a tremendous success while it happened. And unfortunately, when he left, then, you know, if the effort's not there every single day, then the program doesn't perpetuate itself. But and there's two areas where I think I'm going to try to do those types of things. One is in recruiting more foster parents for the state. We have some wonderful families that are taking care of foster kids, but there just aren't enough of them, and, mm-hmm. and we right. don't have enough choices when it comes to putting a foster child in a home that's ideal for his or her circumstances. And some of these kids have been through
several different families,
and they're just, you know, I mean, they have, you know, special needs and challenges that you need a particular type of family to be able to right. deal with appropriately, and we just don't have enough right. choices right now. And it's, you know, being a foster family is I mean, God bless those folks. That
absolutely.
Is, you know, that
absolutely.
Is a tough undertaking, mm-hmm. but we need more people to do it, and I want to go out and try to get more to do it. And the other thing I want to try to do is sort of a variation on what Tom Carper did, which is that we've got our schools basically stop operating at the end of the school day, and we have these great physical facilities that sit empty once the bell rings and the kids mm-hmm. leave. And mm-hmm. I'm very interested in trying to get some of our larger businesses to, again, partner up with some of these schools, help financially in terms of being able to keep the schools open, and then also provide some of their people to be able mm-hmm. to have some activities going on in the schools after mm-hmm. school hours are over. So, mm-hmm. you know, those are things that have nothing to do with the day-to-day function of state government, but mm-hmm. again, because, you know, you have a title, you can get into people and try to convince them to participate in those kinds of things.
Right. Would you be, you know, you were talking about the idea of getting businesses to partner up, you know, with schools in order to provide some extended services. Would you have any thoughts about expanding that partnership, making it, you know, sort of churches, schools, and businesses? Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that I live in the city, and I live in a neighborhood that's basically anchored by churches. And one of the things that's sort of difficult to find is, or to make happen, is to get churches involved in public efforts, because you always have the questions over whether or not you've got, you know, the right separations there.
Right.
But, you know, churches can bring a lot of bodies and a lot of people who are interested, and, you know, businesses can bring other types of roles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just wondering if you, you know, would include churches in some of that partnership.
Oh, yeah. Now, you're preaching to the choir, if you will, in terms of the involvement of faith-based organizations. And mm-hmm. when I came back to Delaware, I actually got my start as a lawyer working in a program that I designed to work out of the basements of many of the churches in the city and homeless shelters and senior centers. I was basically running legal aid clinics mm-hmm. out of these organizations mm-hmm. and got to see firsthand how effective they can be, as you were saying, as an anchor for the community mm-hmm. and just as a venue for people who may need help in some way to try to direct them to the right place. And what I was doing had nothing to do with the church's religious mission. I mean,
right.
I'm Jewish.
Right.
Just that I was, you know, I was there, and they had people either in their congregation or in their neighborhood who needed help, and part of their mission was to help people who need help, and they were mm-hmm. directing people to me. So I mm-hmm. think that there is, if they are willing, if churches, synagogues, you know, what have you, other community organizations are willing, that absolutely there's a role for them to play. And I actually put out a press release 3 or 4 months ago with Reverend Bullock and Bishop Weeks talking about the fact that we in Delaware are one of the only states that doesn't have someone in state government who tries mm-hmm. to help faith-based organizations figure out that difference that you were talking about what's okay and
right.
what's not okay, because
right.
there are some things that cross the line,
right.
and also try to get access to some federal funds that are out there for faith-based organizations
mm-hmm.
that other states are getting that we're not, because
okay.
other states have, you know, a government person who helps faith-based organizations to the, you know, to the programs that are available, and
mm-hmm.
we don't have that, so we're
mm-hmm.
essentially passing up resources that are available at the national level. And Barack Obama has talked about this as well,
right.
and
he,
but he's also been very clear about the fact that there are lines, and that, you know, you need to
protect,
you know,
against discrimination.
Part of doing right. this right is making sure that, you know, people don't cross the line.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Your
good.
Opponent and his running mate talked yesterday or Thursday about splitting DENREC up into two separate agencies. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
I think that's a silly idea, and that it will not make any difference in terms of addressing the real need to mm-hmm. actually have stricter enforcement of our environmental laws and regulations.
Right.
Just moving moving people's desks and chairs around isn't going to deal with the core problem, which I believe, and I don't think this is an oversimplification, mm-hmm. is that the agency hasn't been strict enough in enforcing regulations and laws that are on the book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I walked into an insurance department 4 years ago where that was also a problem, and where there were laws and regulations on the books that in large part were, you know, the same as they were in other states, but they simply weren't being enforced. And we simply said, okay, we're going to enforce them now. Mm-hmm. And it's been difficult going, and it's, you know, we've had some of our decisions challenged in court at mm-hmm. times, mm-hmm. And gotten a lot of political and other types of pressure to stop doing it, but we've kept doing it, and the result is that clearly is not that insurance companies don't ever do anything wrong in Delaware, because they still do frequently. But I will tell you that in spite of all the outreach efforts and advertising that we do for the office, complaints against insurance companies in Delaware are down 25% from January 2005 to the present. We have right. to actually tabulate them as part of our performance measures right. for the General Assembly. And we have not been able to find any other state in America where complaints against insurance companies are down at all, much less being down by that amount. Right. So our sense is that, you know, by doing what we did and imposing some, you know, historic fines against some insurers for doing things that they shouldn't, that the message has finally started trickling down to the folks on the front lines who handle people's claims and mm-hmm. interact with policyholders, that you can't do some of this stuff anymore. And I think that same approach could be very effective in dealing with our environmental laws and regulations. I mean, once you demonstrate, and it doesn't take a lot of demonstrations, that right. you're serious about enforcing the law, the message gets out. And I'll give you one example that I think is a pretty vivid one. Two years ago, I don't remember the exact date, the state actually put out some pretty good regulations regarding air emissions from stationary power sources. About I think about 75% of the particle emissions in Delaware and mercury emissions that come from stationary sources mm-hmm. come from three power plants. Right. I mean, lots of it comes from cars, but right. in terms of, you know, buildings, right. you're talking about Edgemore Power Plant.
Which I live right next to.
Congratulations. I'm trying to help you, man. The McKee plant in Dover and right. the Indian River Power Plant down in Sussex County. Mm-hmm. And they put these regulations out, went through a very thorough process of what was fair, what wasn't,
right.
and they would have reduced in a pretty substantial way, and starting pretty soon, particle emissions that cause childhood asthma, mercury mm-hmm. emissions that cause neurological problems, I mean, some of the really bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately after they put these regulations out, all three of the power plants hired lawyers and began threatening to file suit, and I think one of them actually did file suit against Denrex, challenging the process that they had used to put these regulations right, together, right. and shortly thereafter, Denrec entered into, you know, quote-unquote consent agreements with right. the power plants that ultimately had the effect of delaying a lot of the pollution reduction mm-hmm. measures and putting in a lot of legal loopholes that I'm fearful down the road right. are going to allow the companies to get out of complying with them mm-hmm. altogether. So
right.
that shouldn't have happened. I mean, you go through a process, a thoughtful process to put together a fair and tough regulation,
mm-hmm.
and then you enforce it, and you don't turn around and undo it as right. soon as it's challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's blame. You can blame Denrec for that, and you can fairly blame the General Assembly for that as well, because that all happened in a very public way, and mm-hmm. the General Assembly could have come in and simply put those, you know, regulations into a law and enforce them that way, and they didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So and as a result of all that, you know, we could have had state-of-the-art national air emission standards, and now we don't. So
right.
That's an awful long way of answering
no,
the question
okay.
of
that's
whether
right.
you know, simply you know, changing people's offices was going to fix
no,
the environment.
I do. I just find it curious that two Republicans are for more government now. But that's
yeah,
just
we
a
didn't,
side
I didn't even get to that. So,
yeah. just a side comment there.
Just jump in a little bit. My business is the environmental business.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things about enforcing these types of regulations is that you know, there is health effects and there are, you know, public benefits for all of that. But you also contribute to the economy some, you know, when you've got people who are, who have to change their behavior.
How's it going?
Sort of,
we're good.
Very good. Mm-hmm. And who have to, you know, up the ante and redo technology, redo processes. You know, these are the kinds of businesses that you want more of in Delaware, I think.
I agree.
And people who are going to be proactive about cleaning up the environment and not necessarily people who are coming in later to clean up the environment, which is what my company does.
Okay.
So I think that there are some real economic benefits to something like that. One of the things that you talk about on your website is things that are interesting to you are reducing some of the environmental health effects that are specific to kids, or at least as well as people understand might be specific to kids, because there's problems with research and problems with the way that risk assessments are done that, you know, don't really account for the fact that, you know, kids are much more vulnerable species than the older of us.
Yep.
And you talk specifically about air and lead paint.
Mm-hmm.
And given the fact that, you know, we're a coastal state, we have a lot of water resources, you know, what would you think about, you know, cleaning up some of the water sources and some of the point source and non-point source pollution?
Well, I think that there's work to be done across the board. I mean, mm-hmm. the reason that I picked the air emission issue is simply because there was, as we were just talking about a moment ago,
mm-hmm.
There was such a recent and telling example of where mm-hmm. the state had been falling short on that particular front.
Right.
But
okay.
I think, you know, water, soil, I mean, I think that there's work to be done across the board. And you mentioned lead paint. I mean, you know, there's a good story to be told with lead paint, which is that we're much better off than we were 10 years ago because of the fact that the schools are now involved in doing screening and we're doing treatment of kids who get screened and who have elevated lead levels. But we have little to no efforts going on in terms of proactive remediation or inspections or anything of that type. So we essentially wait until we find a kid who's already sick, and then we go find out where he lived and try to clean the building up. But we know, as a general matter, what types of buildings are likely to have elevated lead levels, and there's no effort going on to in any sort of prospective way, you know,
to remediate
it. Try to fix them going forward. A disproportionate number of them are in the city simply because the buildings in the city are older. And you know, we need to deal with that because, you know, there are lots of things that are bad for kids. But you know, having a high lead level in your blood can just be devastating for a kid in a permanent kind of way.
Okay.
This has been a DelawareLiberal.net production. I'm Liberal Geek. Thanks for listening.